Good evening. You're listening to Revision Media at revisionmedia.org. I'm your host, Richard Carey. And this is Arcane Semantics. Well, tonight we have a guest for the listeners. I'm very pleased to announce we're going to be having Scott Tips joining us. Now, Scott is the president of the National Health Federation, and he's been the president for the past 10 years. So he's going to be joining us a bit later in the show. I would like to take the time before that to describe a bit more of the sort of work that Scott has been involved with the National Health Federation. And it is very interesting because this has a lot to do with what Scott will often refer to as health freedom. He's a strong advocate of us, each of us, having the right to make our final say, to make the determination on what we do and do not put into our bodies. And so much which relates to disease, the medical industrial complex, the pharmaceutical industry, is dependent on treating illness and disease, not curing people, not preventative measures. And anything that does focus on such, obviously, is a very large threat to the profits of these industries. So that really has a lot to do with what we're all up against, for the future of all races, nations, peoples, to have, the best and most reasonably priced, inexpensive, when you're talking about supplements, vitamins, minerals, and the like, when you're talking about, just anything related to also, focusing on preventative measures, not just treating problems as they come up. And, we find more and more people who do research into these matters see that a lot of these supplements and preventative measures are really the key, to really being healthy, a lot more than those in power with profit would like you to believe. And a lot of people are probably going to be rather surprised if this sort of information is new much. People have things stacked against them, when they actually do have this level of integrity. That's a word that Scott Tips values very highly, integrity. And he's been doing this quite a long time. I have a bit of his bio here I could start with, actually. Scott Tips, as I said, is the president General Counsel for the National Health Federation. Over the last 17 years, Scott has participated in more Codex meetings than any other health freedom activist, and for more than 30 years has been an attorney specializing in FDA law. Now, Scott Tips attended UCLA as an undergraduate major in history, where he obtained his BA degree, magna cum laude, followed quickly by a year at Sorbonne University in Paris, France. Returning to the United States, he then studied law at the University of California, Berkeley School of Law, Bolt Hall. At Bolt Hall, he was accepted onto the California Law Review, where he became its managing editor and helped to bring that journal back on schedule. After 3 years of study, Scott obtained his Juris Doctorate degree from Boalt Hall, and then quickly took and passed the California bar exam. So a California licensed attorney, he has specialized in food and drug law and trademark law, but also engages in business litigation, general business law, and nonprofit organizations with an international clientele. Since 1989, Scott has been the general counsel for the National Health Federation, the world's oldest health freedom organization for consumers, as well as the editor-in-chief of its magazine for members only, Health Freedom News. In 2007, he became NHF president and has been a frequent speaker for the organization and for health freedom on several continents. A legal columnist, Scott writes a monthly column for Whole Foods magazine called Legal Tips, a column he started several decades ago. And currently he's primarily occupied with health freedom issues arising from national governments and such international organizations as the Codex Alimentarius Commission's attempts to limit individual freedom of choice in health matters in general. And in that capacity, he has compiled, edited, and published a book on the subject entitled Codex Alimentarius, Global Food Imperialism. I actually have a hard copy of that publication. I wanted to share a bit from the foreword, where Scott, really puts in perspective some of the battle that he's been up against here. He also attends Codex meetings worldwide and has attended more Codex meetings than any other health freedom activists, than all other health freedom activists combined. So, this is a gentleman who's been really dedicated to this cause in an altruistic manner, to say the least. And we're very happy that he's making some time for us today. He actually is usually abroad, spends most of his time in Europe, because a lot of these conferences will rotate which country they're in. I'm sure that's part of that decision on his part, but he's actually in the States during the next couple of weeks, beginning today, for some events, and makes it a bit more functional to be here with us. Now, I have mentioned just a general description of his focus, but it's very interesting how Scott points out that the U.S. position is antithetical to the very principles of freedom this country was founded upon. And if we don't have these choices to govern what we do and do not put into our body, even the right to the information about these options, well, Europe generally follows suit, all things with regard to freedom of information and speech in recent decades from the U.S. And so we certainly have to pave the way, or it's definitely going to decline in the opposite. Now, the law of unintended consequences is a concept Scott likes to frequently address here, and regarding the entire existence of this group, this organization and these meetings, Codex Alimentarius, and basically, that's Latin, and this is food code. It means nothing more than food code, but A lot of prestigious organizations filled with bureaucrats will prefer something with the Latin name for the effect, of course. But these quote-unquote guidelines, as Scott puts it, are intended to govern international trade in vitamins and minerals. It really seems to be more and more like a Frankenstein monster the more I look into what Scott has to say on these meetings in general. Codex guidelines for vitamin and mineral food supplements are intended to those jurisdictions where supplements are regulated as foods, where they are regulated instead as drugs. These guidelines are more of a curiosity than something of importance. Now, I should point out I'm quoting a few key concepts from the foreword of Scott's book here. I don't want to be, seen to be plagiarizing or anything, but I'm going to mention it a bit more in this first hour here before Scott joins us. And another key point he brings at the foreword, severe restrictions upon the sale and information given about vitamins and minerals, are really the crux of this, modeled after the European Union's Food Supplements Directive of 2002, these guidelines take an anti-health freedom, bureaucratic-friendly approach to natural substances that purports to protect health and lives through severe restrictions upon the sale and information given about vitamins and minerals. By making health-saving information about vitamins and minerals virtually impossible to obtain, and by limiting consumer access to health-benefiting vitamins and minerals at levels that will actually make a physiological difference, these arguable, well-intentioned regulators are ensuring the ill health of future generations. And the detrimental consequences of a leveling process called harmonization, I'm sure Scott as well can go into a bit more detail for you about it. It's really an underhanded way of bringing down the health potential and rights, both in America and in Europe, playing off each other and really using perception to help direct policy and decision making. Some government agencies which attend the Codex meetings are nothing more than field offices for corporate interests. There's another way that Scott describes the situation. As bankers further restrict access to merchant accounts, for that matter, they are criminalizing the successful sale of dietary supplements arbitrarily via the online merchant rather than a regulatory agency. Now, this issue with merchant accounts being under attack, well, as a method of attack, something the most recent periodical of the National Health Federation has been covering. Scott did an article describing this current issue that has been growing. He might shed a bit more light on that as well in the second hour here. It's not like someone like myself is too surprised. All the quest for greed and profit in these industries, but nonetheless, the more I see evidence of how calculated this is, folks, it's really. I don't know, in a way it is more inspiring to work that much more against it, inform people that much more. Because I guess you do see a light at the end of the tunnel, you know, when you see how much we've been neglecting our bodies. It's no wonder the sort of costs we have to endure for all things health-related are what they are. If we could get out of that vicious circle, that vicious loop a bit, perhaps it could be a powerful chain reaction for nations across the globe here, across the planet. I'd like to try to touch on some of these other related topics of nutrition guidelines and just some of the different conferences and also other focuses that the National Health Organization has had. We'll ask Scott, about some of these other things as well here tonight. Anyone who's joining late, we are talking about the National Health Federation, and its president, Scott Tipps, has agreed to do an interview with us here tonight. I'm just trying to go over a little more about the topic first here so that, he has a good foundation with the listeners for what he wants to cover. But there's definitely a lot of concerns regarding the vitamin and mineral area. Everything from vitamin labeling, concerns about the amounts, both to be effective or what many, are wary of being dangerous, natural vitamins, and all the propaganda out there. I mentioned the pharmaceutical industrial complex and medical industrial complex, what they have at stake here. But regulations are really not focused on safety as much as a bureaucratic stronghold, protecting corporate interests and free choice is an obstacle for these people. Natural therapies, holistic doctors, we've heard so much about murders. They're not always depicted as murders, of course, but holistic doctors have been dying more and more in recent months and years here. And usually these stories get swept under the table too easily by most media. It's not a hot enough topic. I don't know. Even for independent media, you'll see a bit covered on some platforms, but perhaps not enough. When you think of how much coverage is given to some of these other subcategories, and just how important this one is, because those with the most money and power certainly get the very best health care. Even a lot of these companies are all too knowledgeable of the dangers which they contribute to. I mean, the Monsanto Corporation, their primary home base, it's become widely known and circulated by now that they have a cafeteria which is exclusively, non-GMO, organic, for everything served there for the employees of Monsanto. They don't have anything to do with consuming their products. Anyone who's worked for Monsanto, I take it, has heard stories from coworkers, have looked into it enough to know where they wouldn't have any employees if this weren't the case. But I'd like to try to touch on the subject of GMOs, if we could have time for it as well with Scott. And vaccines, I know, are another issue the National Health Federation focuses on quite a bit. Currently, it's actually a very hot issue in Italy. There's an Italian vaccine campaign. You can find some of the interviews with Scott Tipps online on YouTube right now regarding this vaccine debate in Italy. They're trying to mandate, make it completely mandatory for all of the population, and It doesn't even seem like a climate where it was that necessary. I think they're just worried about the near future, where more and more people, with the explosion of information the internet has brought to us and how much lying we've seen in the corporate media, it's only a matter of time before, you know, more people will be on to all of these vaccines realities. And I think they're anticipating for that ahead of time in a lot of our countries here. Now, I mentioned this book that Scott has published. Very excellent book. I recommend you go out and get it. I've seen it on Amazon, Goodreads. You can find it very easily. Codex Alimentarius, Global Food Imperialism. And this is a collection of articles on Codex, compiled and edited by Scott Tipps himself, but it has quite a few writers and contributors, primarily from attendees of the Codex meetings over the years, including some of the first years of the, I really don't know what to call it at this point. Perhaps Scott could could describe it in that way better than myself, because it really seems like it's full of ill intent. And basically this push toward globalism that we're seeing in so many industries and so many facets of our lives, to have control, centralized control for everything you require in your life is the goal of those in power, basically. If you can make sure that no certain region of the planet, no certain region is able to provide everything, manufacture everything they need, the population able to grow all the food they need for their local region, all of the services and products, energy, natural resources, fuel, etc., whatnot, then you can fight back against this globalist system. That's exactly what all of these agendas, you hear about Agenda 21 now, I think they're calling it Agenda 31, is it, or something? I forget exactly, but they realize they're a bit off schedule, and this globalism often gets sold to people as an altruistic, benign, sort of all caring parent organization for the population as a whole. It's so I don't know, it's so easy for a lot of people to not even question a lot of the motives behind, just so many organizations and changes with law toward the international totalitarian sort of direction. Too many people buy into how good the intentions of these overlords could be. I know a lot of people are busy with their day-to-day lives, It can be difficult. A lot of people are just trying to make enough money and take care of their family, maybe have a little free time to maintain sanity every week. But that's where people out here in the independent media, we're trying to provide you with that information that many in power would rather you did not have, giving you many more options than you thought were even possible. So that, I think, is a positive way to look at these things, is knowledge is power, as much as a cliche as that is. One of my friends recently posted on social media a very excellent observation to keep in mind as well, which is that telling the truth itself can be such an empowering act. You can have such an amazing effect from it. on your psyche, on your energy levels. It really is contagious and can really manifest. We all do need to direct our intent more towards creating a more positive future. So I'm going to read a bit more from the foreword to Scott's publication, his book. I am very happy that we have Scott Tipps here tonight. Scott Tipps, the president of the National Health Federation. I'm going to now read a bit from his foreword here, which is really great. Gives a lot of good detail, on what we're up against and, just what has been accomplished thus far. The title again is Codex Alimentarius, Global Food Imperialism, a compendium of articles on Codex compiled and edited by Scott Tipps. At the beginning here, he talks about Codex in general and this global food imperialism. As is often the case with governmental programs and the ostensibly good intentions that are professed to accompany them, the implementation of these programs and the resulting effects upon the individuals affected by them are invariably negative. Whether it has been the American government's 35-plus-year-old failed war on cancer, or its equally long and equally unsuccessful war on drugs, for example, each massive increase in taxpayer money thrown at the problem of the government has not resulted in a cure or solution, but simply more bureaucracy, more tunnel vision as to the path to take, and an ever-receding goal still stretching out of reach. It is perhaps the prime example of the law of unintended consequences. This law of nature, which says that an action or program will have the opposite or at least unexpected effect of that intended, seems to dog government actions no matter what they are. Codex Alimentarius, an international intergovernmental program, enjoys no special exemption from this law. Codex Alimentarius is actually a noble concept, the idea, at least the idea put forth to the public, has been for countries throughout the world to adopt uniform food standards that would allow the free and unhindered flow of food goods among countries and to consumers. This is an idea with which many of us can agree and even embrace. But as you will read in this book, the actual implementation of this laudable idea is falling far short of the ideal itself. Indeed, the implementation of this ideal is having the opposite effect of its stated purpose. The Food Code. Codex Alimentarius is Latin for food code. It is, and is to be, since the process is still ongoing, a set of standards covering many different categories of food. The Codex Alimentarius Commission is the international body establishing these global trade standards for foods, created in 1963 as a result of resolutions passed in 1961 at a Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, conference, and now sponsored jointly by the World Health Organization, WHO, and the FAO of the United Nations. Codex has some 27 active committees dealing with various food and food labeling issues, from fish and infant feeding formulas to food additives and vegetable proteins. And each committee is hosted in turn by a particular country that provides both the chairman and the meeting place in that country. The stated goal of the commission is to promote and protect the health of the public. This follows from the FAO's own stated purpose of, quote, achieving food security for all, unquote, and its desire, quote, to make sure people have regular access to enough high-quality food to lead active, healthy lives, unquote. With the establishment of the World Trade Organization, WTO, in 1995, and the subsequent institution of various trade and other agreements, an additional goal of removing barriers to trade has also emerged. And now this goes on to discuss the CCNFSDU. The committee concerned with food supplements is the one with the annoyingly long acronym. The Codex Committee on Nutrition and Foods for Special Dietary Uses, CCNFSDU, which is hosted and chaired by Germany. Typically, the CCNFSDU meets in Bonn or near Bonn every November, although the committee meeting in October to November 2006 took place in Chiang Mai, Thailand, in deference to third world sensibilities. As its name implies, the CCNFSDU covers a number of agenda items in its meetings, including the ever-controversial infant formula standards, dietary fiber guidelines, proposals for nutrient content claims, and risk analysis. The CCNFSDU chairman is Dr. Rolf Grossklaus, a German functionary who wields considerable control over the proceedings and who only occasionally faces revolts from the delegate attendees. And only then, if he has been particularly high-handed. So these people generally comply with this gentleman. Okay, continuing. The delegates to these committee meetings are themselves almost universally regulated bureaucrats and functionaries themselves. Largely out of touch with the interests of the consumers they purport to represent. The United States delegation, for example, consists of the U.S. representative, a Food and Drug Administration, FDA employee, and her assistant delegate, yet another FDA employee, as well as the smattering of special interest industry persons who may or may not be listened to by the FDA delegate, depending upon whose interests they represent. To make sure that these private individuals who plump up the U.S. delegation are properly hamstrung, the FDA requires, as a condition of their attendance, that they sign a form promising that they will not lobby other countries' codex delegates at these meetings. For 2 years, I myself, this being Scott, was a member of the U.S. delegation attending the CCNFSDU meetings in Berlin, Germany. I found that the views I expressed on behalf of the National Health Federation, NHF, a nonprofit health freedom organization representing the views of thousands of pro-supplement and pro-health individuals, mostly fell on deaf ears. It was not until 2002 when the then U.S. delegate, Dr. Elizabeth Yetley, refused to let me continue being on the delegation that I was spurred into action to obtain official codex recognized status for the NHF as an international non-governmental organization, INGO, and could then attend and speak out at the CCNFSDU and other codex meetings unfettered by FDA handcuffs. Indeed, it is really thanks to Dr. Yetley's refusal, which completely backfired, that the NHF could begin to have an impact at the Codex meetings. Often in speaking out at the meetings, the NHF has taken the position opposite to that of the United States, which U.S. position the NHF has found to be antithetical to the very principles of freedom upon which the United States was founded. This goes on to cover the guidelines. Despite the often fierce First World versus Third World battle over infant formulas, this particular committee achieved even more notoriety and thus the object of focus for health freedom activists around the world. In 1994, when it took up more directly the issue of vitamin and mineral food supplements, in doing so, it began establishing, quote, guidelines, unquote, intended to govern the international trade in vitamins and minerals. Interestingly enough, these Codex guidelines for vitamin and mineral food supplements are intended to apply only to those jurisdictions, read, countries, where supplements are regulated as foods, where they are regulated instead as drugs, such as in supplement-hating Norway. These guidelines are more of a curiosity than something of importance. So, the game has been rigged almost from the beginning. In a bureaucratic form of heads I win, tails you lose, the guidelines will clamp down on both the quality and availability of supplements being sold as food, while having no effect on those supplements legally classified as drugs. The NHF, along with the freedom-loving South African delegate, Antoinette Buizen, fought hard to prevent or at least slow down the establishment of the recently adopted guidelines for vitamin and mineral food supplements. Obviously modeled after the European Union's Food Supplements Directive of 2002, these guidelines take an anti-health freedom, bureaucratic-friendly approach to natural substances that purports to protect health and lives through severe restrictions upon the sale and information given about vitamins and minerals. Yet, by making health-saving information about vitamins and minerals virtually impossible to obtain, and by limiting consumer access to health-benefiting vitamins and minerals at levels that will actually make a physiological difference, these arguably well-intentioned regulators are ensuring the ill health of future generations. Used as a toxicological model of dealing with substances they know little about and hence mistrust, these Codex bureaucrats are painting everything in their path with a very wide brush and the same color of paint. Again, the law of unintended consequences is at work here. Moment, folks. And in November 2004, at the Bonn, Germany CCNFSDU meeting, South Africa and the National Health Federation were the only delegations opposing approval by the committee of these harsh guidelines. According to Codex procedural rules, the guidelines were then required to be submitted to the next regular meeting of the Codex Elementarius Commission for final review and approval. So, it was written then that at the July 2005 Codex Elementarius Commission meeting in Rome, Italy, and with Ms. Buyzen absent, the NHF was the one and only voice out of literally hundreds of attendees to speak up and oppose the commission's adoption of the guidelines. It is important to remember, though, that at present, these guidelines are nothing more than a framework, with maximum permitted upper levels for vitamins and minerals to be slotted in under the risk assessment approach. Ever fearful of vitamins and minerals, which they have never understood, the Europeans are striving to keep a firm lid on the maximum permitted upper levels. And unfortunately, instead of opposing this straitjacket, the Americans, Canadians, and many others are willing, even eager, midwives to this process. While the birthing process still has a few years to go, in the regulatory timescale, this is the mere blink of an eye. To us, bureaucrats move glacially slow. But in their strange Einsteinian universe, the few years left to complete and fill in the guidelines framework is a heart-pounding rocket ride to the stars. Very, very figurative, interesting way he puts it there. And now the topic of harmonization that I was getting to, which is very manipulative from what I'm finding. What many health freedom activists around the world have long ago realized, however, is that these euphemistically called, quote, guidelines, unquote, will be used not only to exclude high-potency American dietary supplements from the European marketplace, but they will also be used, either directly or by way of example, to stifle the domestic national markets in supplements as well through a leveling process called, quote, harmonization, unquote. Importantly, though, harmonization of food standards is not just a codex process, but is a deliberately planned interlocking process being fitted together through a number of treaties, quote, arguments, unquote, and regulatory, quote, handshakes, unquote, that, once in place, will make it nearly impossible for any country's citizens to shake themselves free of this straitjacket. These harmonization processes include, but are not limited to, the World Trade Organization, the Sanitary and Phytosanitary SPS agreements, the Technical Barriers to Trade TBT agreement, the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, the Central American Free Trade Agreement, CAFTA, the Trilateral Corporation Charter, and the Planned North American Union, NAU. As a side note, I'll put in here, I'm sure Trilateral Corporation Charter is a subset of the Trilateral Commission. Now that makes me think of the comments William Cooper had on the origins of the Trilateral Commission in his book Behold a Pale Horse there. I would not at all expect anything other than this being under that organization. And well, with that in mind, it is rather laughable to assume the altruistic, benign motives of these organizations. Getting back here, and if any of you are still under the illusion that any government, but especially the American government, is a supporter of health freedom or a protector of health freedom rights in any way, then you need only look to the actions and words of the FDA. Yeah, we all thought that was such a wonderful organization for us, right, folks? It goes on. This agency has not only announced its intention to harmonize U.S. laws and regulations to international standards, but it has been acting upon the world stage for years to do just that. It does not matter to the FDA that the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act of 1994, DSHEA, was passed by Congress in order to protect certain of the health freedoms of Americans. The FDA has always hated this law, which removed FDA's arbitrary enforcement powers, but not, as is often claimed, its regulatory powers. And has seen that although it cannot yet directly repeal DSHEA, it can and will outflank DSHEA through harmonization with anti-freedom rules, regulations, and, quote, guidelines, unquote. It is not the purpose of this foreword to explain how the process of harmonization will affect the North American and other global markets in general and dietary supplements in particular, but rather through the following collection of articles gathered together and presented to you in this compilation, written as they were by many of those individuals who have monitored, argued, and written about Codex over numerous years. You will more completely grasp what many have realized and argued is nothing more than a net slowly descending over our collective heads to benefit a few. Many have claimed that somewhere along the way, Codex was hijacked by financial interests antithetical to the true health interests of consumers, using propagandistic phrases such as, quote, the need to protect consumer health, unquote. These commercial interests have allied themselves with the naturally future-fearing tendencies of government bureaucrats to suppress the rapidly rising use of dietary supplements. What better way to eliminate the competition than to suppress it with regulatory and legislative handcuffs? The pharmaceutical industry, with a global market of more than $600 billion, will act and has been acting to protect its commercial interests. And this goes on to mention the players, some of the individuals involved. A little later, it mentions a film called We Become Silent, which covers this. And then it goes on later to state what the future holds. Although the Codex Alimentarius Commission has adopted the guidelines, there are still two arenas in which this health freedom drama will play out. These are the two areas that bear the most watching. First, since the guidelines are nothing more than a framework, they are not usable until the maximum permitted levels are established. Through the application of risk analysis and risk assessment. So the fight here will be over how high the vitamin and mineral potencies will be set, with the pro-health freedom forces agitating for the highest possible levels and the pro-pharmaceutical interests wanting to minimize the upper levels and hence the effectiveness as much as possible. Science is on the side of the proponents of health freedom, but the, quote, beauty, unquote, of science merged with politics is that it can be easily manipulated to say whatever its manipulators want it to say. The future will tell us whether truth and scientific integrity prevail or whether politics as usual will rule. The second arena, which will be the application, or will be the application of the guidelines domestically within each country's national boundaries, otherwise known as harmonization, in quotes, harmonization. Allegedly, countries are lining up like lemmings to accept whatever cliff edge codex standards would have them jump off of. As in the case of the development of codex standards, harmonization is not simply a process, it has actually become a way of thinking. Numerous countries, institutions, and individuals have come to accept harmonization as inevitable. In a sort of Borg-like resistance's futile fog of mind, they have ceased to question the value of harmonization as inevitable. I'm sorry, they have ceased to question the value of harmonization or to compare the advantages with the disadvantages, or especially to consider that there might be a far better way to handle the health issues presented to them. It has often been said that to know the future, one should remember the past. We have Scott Tips here with us. Hello, Scott. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you just fine, Richard. Thank you. Can you hear me?
Oh, yes. You're coming in perfectly. Thank you, sir.
Oh, good. All right. Now, I'm not sure how to mute my button. Oh, I see. Okay. Never mind. I can mute when necessary.
Okay. Well, I'm so glad you took the time to be here while in the States. I know it has been since August last year, I think I was in contact with Catherine. I'm glad we could make it work for you. And I actually spent the first hour describing a bit to the listeners about your history and also about Codex Alimentarius. I read a bit from your book, Codex Alimentarius. Yeah, well, the foreword I focused on, I felt it had a lot of information.
All right.
And just about the entire, virtually the entire foreword, a couple little paragraphs in the middle I maybe didn't have time for, I covered. So the listeners have a little introduction to your work, and I read your bio to them. So please, you have the whole hour, sir, whenever you wish.
Thank you. Thank you for that, Richard, and I'm happy to be on. And I just had a big trip from Europe yesterday to Los Angeles today. So and a lot has been going on in Europe, but since you've already really educated listeners on a lot about what the National Health Federation is about, I probably don't need to go into any of those kind of details, but we've been really focusing on what you mentioned quite correctly, the Codex Alimentarius issues, and that is our big sort of the bugaboo, if you can use that term these days, the big bugaboo, the big gorilla in the room that a lot of people don't know about, or if they do, they discount. But they really shouldn't, because Codex Alimentarius is establishing food laws around the world. I mean, 99% of the world's population is represented through their countries at Codex. And so it has quite grand coverage, and it affects whatever they decide upon in these sort of, they aren't really secret, that would be unfair to them, but let's just say no one really attends except for the delegates and the National Health Federation. And we're there making a big stink about a lot of the things that they're doing, which range from food additives to supplements to contaminants in food to you name it, glyphosate, aspartame, and aluminum in food additives, to dumbing down our nutrition and our vitamin supplements and the like. And we're there, we're the bad boys of Codex, as they call us, because we're the ones who rub their noses in all the dirty work that they've been doing and point out their faults and call their attention to it and the world's attention to it. So, and anyone who's interested can go to our website and sign up for the e-newsletter, and they'll get periodic reports about what's going on. It doesn't cost you anything other than the time to get onto thenhf.com, the homepage, and click on the e-newsletter thing and then sign up, and then you'll be there and you won't get spammed.
But, okay, so that... I'm sorry. So that's thenhf.com.
Exactly. Yeah. And there, I think it's near the top or on the right-hand side is a button for the e-newsletter. And if there isn't, it's not hard to find. But we just put a few things out a month, not many, so people don't get their inboxes overloaded. And we don't, you know, we really respect people's privacy. We don't trade or exchange or sell the email list to anyone else. It just stays with us. And that's it. And but at Codex, it's really funny, Richard, because for the first 9 years that we attended, maybe 10 years that we attended the Codex meetings, we really had defeat after defeat after defeat. And, you know, there were people who told us, Scott, you're wasting your time, NHF, you're wasting your time there. But we hung in, and by the 10th year of really attending Codex meetings, we started to have victory after victory, because finally the other delegates and others were realizing that we were talking some good sense, and we weren't just some ridiculous fringe group that was making life difficult for them. You know, we had the Iranian delegate come up to us once at one meeting, I think it was in Hong Kong, where these meetings are held all throughout the world, as you know, Richard, but the Hong Kong meeting on food additives. And at that meeting, the Iranian delegate came up to us, said, you know, your NHF is hated here. And I said, really? Why? And he said, well, because every time you open your mouth, you cost them money. And he was quite serious about it. You know, he's actually a pretty good guy. Canadian born and bred and moved back to Iran, and he represented Iran. But the thing about it is that it really taught us a lesson, which is you just have to keep persevering. And we've always really found that to be true anyway. So maybe it didn't teach us a lesson, but it reinforced a lesson that you just keep on persevering at anything, and eventually you'll make inroads. And we did. We were able to get removed from the food additives, half of the food additives that contained aluminum. And the remaining 50% were reduced by 50%. So effectively, we eliminated about 75% of the aluminum from food additives. And in 2008, when I first spoke up in China, because the Food Additives Committee is hosted by the Chinese government, when I first spoke up about it, I was the sole voice, except curiously enough for the chairman. I was the sole voice in the room, NHF certainly was, speaking out against aluminum and food additives. And then finally, we were able to convince the European Union to join our side. And that's when we started making some real inroads. Because at these committee meetings and the commission meeting, you know, there's like the country delegates, literally from Albania to Zimbabwe. And these are all FDA-type bureaucrats. And then they have the INGOs, the International Non-Governmental Organizations. And 95% of those are trade organizations. You know, they represent Monsanto, they represent DuPont, they represent the World Sugar Council. They have, you know, all the dairy industry, all these different International Council of Grocery Manufacturers Association, these kind of groups. And then there are five of us, five INGOs, that are consumer groups. And of the five, the National Health Federation is the only health freedom group. So these others are kind of leftist consumer groups that we get along with on contamination issues and that sort of thing, but not on vitamin and mineral content, because they think those are super dangerous and should be regulated just maybe more than even drugs. So we have our issues with them at the nutrition committee meeting where that's dealt with. But on issues like contamination of infant formula and the like, they're really good guys and gals, and their hearts are in the right place. GMOs and those kind of issues, ractopamine, which has been added to pork feed and that sort of thing. Those are all issues that we argue together on, and really have done a good job in stopping that in most instances. Is that kind of going in the direction you wanted me to discuss, or Can I get into more detail, less detail? Tell me, and I'll be happy to.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, certainly as much detail as you like. We have until, 9:57. It's 9:10 okay. Right now.
Okay. And, I just want, go ahead, Richard. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off.
Oh, no. But I definitely along the way, maybe if we could talk a bit more about just how some of the ways, other than just what is a what the rules that they decide mm-hmm. on dictate. But we have the classification in some countries as foods and some as drugs. And you mentioned how America can follow suit of Europe, just to look good for appearances, and therefore it kind of ruins things for everyone. And the harmonization, I don't know. It's just very manipulative, but yeah, please.
You bring up a very good point, Richard, and it's one that actually, to be honest, I often don't talk about on the air, but I really should. So I appreciate your saying that. And that is that, the NHF, by the way, has existed for 62 years. We are older than Codex, but Codex was founded about 54 years ago. And through a series of resolutions by the Food and Agriculture Organization and the World Health Organization, you may have already explained this to your listeners, but the important point is that in 1994, with the Uruguay round of treaty negotiations on GATT, the then existing international trade agreement, GATT, they really changed GATT into the World Trade Organization, the WTO. And it was at that point that any of the standards and guidelines that were created by Codex started having substantial teeth to them. Before countries could go along with it or not, it didn't really matter. And even if it did, how was one country to enforce the other? To enforce a trade standard or a food standard. Well, they really couldn't. But what WTO did when it was created in 1994 after the Uruguay round of treaty negotiations was it gave actual teeth to the standards, not just food standards, but other standards as well. What that meant is that Codex creates standards and guidelines. They aren't laws. They're just suggestions, so to speak. But what Codex is meant to do is eliminate the barriers to international trade in food. So what's the effective part of that? This all may sound boring to your listeners, but if they'll just hang in for a minute, they'll see how incredibly significant this all is. And that is that, so let's take a recent example, ractopamine, which they give to pigs and poultry in America, Canada, Mexico, basically the whole Western Hemisphere. All the way down to Argentina and Chile. And what it does is it creates downer pigs when it's given to pigs, some froth at the mouth. I think it's actual animal cruelty. But the reason the producers like it and the reason the drug pushers like it is because, they get more money out of it. It creates the Arnold Schwarzenegger effect, I call it. It makes the pork meat meatier and less fat. It's leaner, less fat, and they can sell it for more money. Well, in the meantime, you and I, if you're eating pork in America or in Canada, you're ingesting ractopamine along with all these other contaminants we get, GMOs, the EMF fields, the glyphosate, the pesticide, other pesticides, all these different things that are contaminating our bodies. And so it's just one more notch on the belt to ill health. So we were stopping that. We stopped it every year for something like 5 years to keep Codex from creating a standard. Why was that important? Because then if a standard is created, Codex is saying this level of ractopamine in pork meat is safe. And so the EU, which adamantly has a zero tolerance level for ractopamine in meat, and has prohibited its importation into the EU countries and member states, then the U.S. can go to the WTO and say, hey, WTO, your trade arbitration panel, The EU isn't engaging in a fair trade practice, and we want them sanctioned. And the WTO will, the arbitrators will say, well, let's look and see, is there a standard there that deals with this? And the first place they look is Codex. And if they find a standard for rectopamine, then they will declare the United States or Brazil or Canada or whichever country brought the trade dispute the victor, and they'll levy a very hefty trade sanction against the EU, against Russia, against China, against any country that prohibits the entry of rectopamine-doped pig meat, pork. And so that's why it became important in 1994. Suddenly you had a lot of businesses and other outfits, including the National Health Federation, suddenly take interest in what was happening at Codex. And that's why Codex is so important, because it's used as a club to beat other countries into submission. Even the threat of a WTO trade dispute, especially in African countries, this is how the U.S. is pushing GMO food products throughout the world, is because Kenya, for example, will just get the mere whisper of a threat that the U.S. will bring a trade dispute, and the U.S. doesn't even have to file the trade dispute. They just say they will. And then Kenya folds like a cheap drunk on a Saturday night binge. So this is how it works. That's why it's so incredibly important. Unfortunately, the rectopamine battle is one we eventually lost. You know, it's like Winston Churchill said, you know, victory is never final. And so we won year after year after year. And then finally, you know, the United States had flown in every two-bit country from every part of the world you can imagine, who had never attended a Codex meeting in their lives. And they voted in favor of, oh, big surprise, the United States. And so this is how they won, by one vote. It's one of the few times you actually vote at Codex. Usually it's done by consensus, which is sort of kind of similar to running an applause meter and deciding who has applauded the most for the singer or the whomever it might be. So in any event, we lost that back in 2013, I think. But at this point, I've probably gone to more Codex meetings than all other health freedom activists combined. And my last one was in July in Geneva at the Codex meeting there, where we dealt with the vitamin levels finally, because that was actually, how many years ago? 8 years ago, our big victory in Germany at the Nutrition Committee, when they were trying to ram through and get the vitamin levels down. Vitamin C, for example, down from poultry 60 milligrams a day, which is ridiculous. That's one orange a day. That's nothing.
They want the levels low enough to be ineffective, so people will turn away from them.
Yeah. Exactly. And it will increase the price, which is another way of achieving that same goal. There are two ways of doing it. I mean, really, there are more than even two, but there are two main ways. They do, as you said, they lower the effectiveness. The other is they raise the price high enough where it wouldn't help. For example, I take, you know, 5,000 to 10,000 units of vitamin D a day, and that costs me about $4 or $5 a month. The similar, actually, I'd say a lower quality product in Finland, where I was giving a speech in 2009 after this meeting I was about to tell you about, I walked into a health food store there. And oh, and by the way, that pill that I take here in the U.S. would be just one pill. But I walked into a Finnish store, in a health food store in Helsinki, and I couldn't even find it, that potency, of course, and I didn't expect to. But what I did find were, if I took almost literally a handful, Richard, of vitamin D capsules, I could get the same amount, but it would cost me about, let's see, if I do the conversion, about $75 a month. So this is kind of a lesson to all of us about the dangers of overregulation, because that is one of the reasons that it's also the taxation structure there, because they tax upon tax upon tax with the value-added tax. And so one of the dangers of overregulation is that, sure, you can have a product that'll save one or two lives. I mean, vitamin D is already incredibly safe. There's no one in 35 years who's been shown to have died from a vitamin D overdose, a natural vitamin D, I should say, vitamin D3. And that's what I was comparing, apples to apples. But so what they do is they heap so many regulations on that make a drug-like process to go through in order to bring your product to market. But what does it do? It prices all the poor people out of being able to buy this. You can't make any claims that would be deemed to be disease or drug claims. So you can't say anything about its efficacy at helping to stimulate the immune system or ward off breast cancer or prostate cancer or the like. And so people don't know to get it or that it'll help prevent the flu. But you can say that about a flu vaccine. And so, and they subsidize the cost, governments do, of the flu vaccines. And so they go in, they get a flu vaccine in Finland instead of buying the vitamin D that they desperately need at that latitude where they get so little sunlight and so few vitamin D producing rays. And so this is a huge problem, and people don't realize that, oh, it sounds great, we'll just heap on a few more regulations, who really cares? But the fact of the matter is those costs are passed on to the consumer, or the businesses stop making the product because it's too costly to make and no one will buy it anyway. So what we need to do is try to lower the regulatory burden on safe products and keep it in place on those that we know are dangerous. And that's where the discussion comes in, because at these Codex meetings, a lot of the delegates, when I pull out at the lunch hour my packet of vitamins to take for lunch, along with lunch, as they're drinking their diet Coca-Cola, they laugh, you know. But then I laugh back at them for drinking their diet Coca-Cola with the heaps of aspartame in it that'll give them a brain tumor and other problems. So this is what goes on. But we've become, from a sort of a fringe group there, we've become really very respected. And what I found at this last meeting, we were actually the one in Geneva in July last, NHF was asked to be one of the five INGOs to address the whole meeting room. There were some 700 delegates registered for the meeting. I don't think there were that many in the room at the time that I spoke or that we spoke, but there were, it was close to that. In any event, I spoke about the need for integrity at Codex, and I wasn't necessarily well received because, of course, they think they have integrity at Codex and that they're using good science, but they really aren't. They're using junk science. They're using a lot of, you know, fake studies that have been done by industry and government hacks. And this is what they put forth. And then the problem, too, is so many people worship government. They think, oh, government's the solution. Yeah, we have these big corporations. This problem I have with some of the other INGOs. Oh, we can trust the government, but we can't trust the businesses. Well, who do they think is the extension, the enforcers for the businesses? It's the government. So the big corporations, the big pharmaceutical industries, the big agricultural companies who have their millions of dollars in lobbying fees paid every year to get their way with the FDA, the Department of Agriculture, and others, they just laugh their heads off. You give more power to the government to enforce fairness and equality and all of that, what are you doing? You're just giving more bullets to the thugs who will, the mafia thugs who will hold you up and make you do what the big companies want. They just laugh their heads off at us because those of us who are so silly as to think that a big government will control them, they know better. They know that that's part of them. You know, it's, and this is what we see at Codex. We see them working hand in glove together to pass standards and guidelines that will lead to laws and regulations that just favor the big businesses over the small and the big guys over the little guys. And they keep, you know.
I was mentioning in the first hour how a lot of the pharmaceutical industry and the hospitals are in the business of treating disease, treating rather than curing. So, I mean, rather than the regulations, a lot of times being about safety and free choice, I think you've used the word before, a bureaucratic stranglehold in favor of the corporations and their interests. Yeah. But I find it very disturbing just how much even information, you know, like, because some of the quotes you mentioned, severe restrictions upon the sale and information about given vitamins and minerals. I mean, if it's you can't even tell us the good things that these things have, and just the definitions. I wanted to ask you about whether it's considered a food or a drug in a given country. Does it always have the same benefits and for the same types of corporations and interests? You know, different countries and different types of companies, or does it vary?
It does vary a bit, but that's a good point. You raised it earlier in the hour as well, or this part of the hour, and you had said something, and I sidetracked myself on it, and I didn't address it, and I want to actually address it. You know, when I first started attending Codex meetings in the year 2000, NHF had sent a reporter to 2 or 3 years worth of meetings before, who just sat up in the public gallery and reported on the meetings, but I attended my first 2 years as a member of the U.S. delegation until they refused to let me back on because I was a little too outspoken. But then that's when NHF, I got NHF its own INGO status, accredited status, so we could have our own microphone and speak out at the meetings and make arguments and the like. But an interesting thing came up in the year 2000. There were some arguments by others. I was still pretty new to the game, so I hadn't really considered this, but they said it's really a rigged game. And then I did write about it later using that other person's argument. And it is a bit of a rigged game because some countries like Germany, for instance, declare that higher potency vitamins are drugs. So they aren't governed by Codex is just about food and drink. You know, Codex Alimentarius literally means food. Food code. And so it doesn't deal with medicinals. It doesn't deal with herbal medicinals. It doesn't deal with medical devices. It doesn't deal with any of those things in the medical realm directly. But indirectly it does. If they can make us sicker by lowering the potency of vitamins, then boy, it'll skew a lot of us towards the medical system and taking their drugs and their medicines instead. But what Germany and some other European countries, really just about every other country than the U.S., has done is they've medicalized high-potency vitamins and minerals so that they aren't even considered within the realm of Codex. They're considered under their drug regimes in those countries. So it does kind of definitions do make a difference. And where you set the levels. But getting back to the 2009 thing, where we were, it was really our first huge success, NHF's first huge success in Codex. And that was when we were able to stop their desire to lower again, going back 15 minutes ago when I first mentioned it, the 60 milligrams of vitamin C a day, they wanted to lower it to 45 milligrams a day. They wanted to lower virtually all the B vitamins by anywhere from 22 to 66% in potency. They wanted to reduce magnesium from 300 milligrams a day as the recommended daily amount. They call it a nutrient reference value, NRV, down to 240, and at the same time increase calcium. And as anyone who knows even a small amount about nutrition, they know that calcium and magnesium are twin minerals, and you want to move it in the other direction. By doing this, by increasing calcium and lowering magnesium level, they are going to increase the deposition of calcium in the soft tissue, like the arteries and skin, and reduce its deposition into hard tissue where it really belongs, like teeth and bones. So these morons, or they knew what they were doing in a demonic way, but were going in the wrong way on that, as well as reducing selenium down. They wanted to reduce it. So we were the only ones to really speak up, other than a kind of a weak cry by Costa Rica, but we were the only ones to really speak up, NHF, and I proceeded to argue for almost an hour on the floor against this, and was stunned when there were two countries who supported us, Iraq and India. And when after that, the chairman announced we were holding back the standards for review later. And when that happened, it killed the momentum. And then it's taken until this year. So we delayed it for 8 years, but it's taken until this year to get the standards completed for it. And then vitamin C is still low, but it went up by 220% because of us. And the B vitamins were saved in most cases, not all cases. The magnesium level, I'm trying to remember now. I think it's the same, but the calcium level, unfortunately, is still too high. And we just had the final decision on vitamin D and vitamin E. And we had a semi-victory on vitamin D, but we lost on the vitamin E. They set it at 13.5 international units a day as the recommended dose. Well, I take 400 a day. So you can see how far off that is. 13.5 international units a day for vitamin E is nothing. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of more people suffer heart attacks because of it. There's a recent study that showed that the longer you've been taking vitamin E, and it's a nice looking chart. You can just, the study had a chart in there. It had several charts actually, but it had a chart that showed the decline. If you've been taking vitamin E for 30 years, like I have, your risk at least at my age, which I won't tell you, but is remarkably lower than the person who's only been taking it for 3 years or no years. And and there's almost a direct correlation between the length of time you've been consuming vitamin E and your risk of a heart attack. And so, and this is amazingly tracks what they showed with this huge study for women taking vitamin E, where it reduced the risk. Oh, of course, the mainstream media always minimizes any of these benefits of vitamins. For example, when the story broke on this women's health study, it studied like 10,000 women over 20 years. You know, the article, the news article that was released on it, at least one I saw, went for, you know, most of the article saying no benefit shown for stomach cancer, no benefit for intestinal cancer, no colon cancer, no benefit from breast cancer, no benefit from this. And then finally, if you stayed with it long enough, down in the 10th paragraph or so, it said, oh, a statistically insignificant correlation of 25% reduction in the heart attack rate. 25% cardiac disease, actually, cardiac disease reduction. 25% from taking 400 international units of vitamin E a day. 25%, if that had been a drug, they would have been trumpeting it from all the towers. If it had been 5% reduction, they'd be trumpeting it as a huge success story for a drug. But for a vitamin that they can't make money off of, no way. And that was for the women who were in the age range of, I'm forgetting the starting age range, but I think it was 18, but it could have been 25. Anyway, whatever that was, it included a lot of women in their fertile period up to the age of 65. But if you just looked at the 50 to 65 age range, the reduction in cardiac disease was 50%. Wasn't 25%, it's 50%. And this correlates a lot with when women go into menopause and then they become much more susceptible to cancer, to heart attacks, to stroke and the like. But what happens is those women in that age range who are taking vitamin E are getting a very heart protective effect from taking it. So maybe they aren't helping the risk of cancer, but they're definitely helping lower or even eliminate the risk of getting a heart attack or heart disease of some sort. So these are the kind of games that go on. And so we've had some successes almost every year at Codex, and then we've had some defeats as well. But this is why it's so incredibly important, because whatever decisions are being made at Codex are the model for the countries regulatory regimes. You know, the U.S. has already declared years ago, 20 years ago, they declared that they would be harmonizing U.S. regulatory, the regulatory regime to codex standards. They said that in black and white in the Federal Register. So that's why when NHF goes to these meetings, it's going to the very top to make a change throughout the world and not just a local change, although it does translate into a local change as it, you know, drifts down from top to bottom.
Yes. And so these vitamin and mineral supplements and the knowledge about them is very important to you and your organization, natural therapies as well. And well, I don't know if you want us to talk a little about vaccines as well. I know that in Italy right now, it's a hot topic. We have about 20.
Yes.
We have about 20 minutes
sure.
left. So wherever you want to fill that with.
Okay. Thanks, Richard, because this is, and I am glad you brought that up, because this is the latest thing that we've been working on. I mean, I have a Codex meeting coming up in December at the Nutrition Committee in Berlin that I'll be going to. But really what's occupied a lot of my attention the last 6 weeks, has been I'm thinking about it, 10 weeks, has been the vaccine issue in Italy. As you know, and as many of your listeners may know, especially those who are already signed on to our email list, is that the Italian government just in July passed the so-called Lorenzin, L-O-R-E-N-Z-I-N, Lorenzin law, which is named after the Italian Minister of Health, Beatrice Lorenzin, which increased the number of mandated vaccines for school children from 4 to 12. And then some last-minute commotion caused the 12 to be reduced down to 10 mandated vaccines. But it still increased the number. And then the fine, which had been set, if you didn't get your school children vaccinated, the fine was 7,500 euros. That was reduced down to 500 euros. But importantly, prior to the passage of this law, each of the regions of Italy, you know, like the Venice region, the Trieste region, other Umbrian region, areas like that, they all could set their own policy on mandated vaccines. And Venice, the Veneto, as they call it, region had really the best record of not mandating vaccines or letting people get out of them very easily if they didn't believe in them. And so with this law, it stirred up all of Italy. There were rallies and demonstrations and commotion throughout all of Italy from the south to the north. And NHF got involved thanks to NHF Sweden. Our branch in Sweden was the first to pull the alarm on this, what was happening. And NHF Sweden executive director Sarah Boo went down to Rome and spoke before a huge crowd of, I don't know, maybe 6,000 people against it. And then NHF Sweden's been doing a lot of research on how to defeat it, how to fight it. But at the same time, I went and started speaking almost every weekend. I was flying to some part of Italy or the other, fortunately not from the United States, but from within Europe. So it wasn't that big a trip. You know, it was sort of like flying from Tucson to San Francisco or something. But in any event, the first weekend I was speaking in Trieste before about 2,000 people, and then I spoke in Treviso at a very well-attended group. I forget the number, but it was a large group as well. Treviso is just north of Venice by about 30 minutes drive. And then I spoke in Rome. Unfortunately, it was a bad selection of a time in Rome, so attendance was really pitiful, but the ones who did attend were really diehard. And Andrew Wakefield was there. You know Andrew Wakefield. And I used to speak with him on, you know, in Ireland. We would travel through Ireland giving speeches back in, 2009, I think, 2008, somewhere around there. But in any event, he was there giving his speech about, you know, the link between autism and certainly the MMR vaccine. And he's such a terrific speaker anyway. And then after that, I went back to the Venice area, and I actually spoke in Venice just September 16th before a crowd of about 8,000 to 10,000 very angry Italians. And we're in our magazine. If you know, any of your listeners join NHF, it's not that expensive. It's just $45 a year. They join and they get the magazine. And in the next issue of the magazine, which is just going to the printer today, Monday, there's a huge article on the vaccine rallies there and what went on and the like. And I think any of your listeners would find it fascinating, because we've shown that the Lorenzen law violates, the mandatory vaccine law violates probably seven or eight different international treaties. It violates about four articles of the Italian Constitution, and it's absolutely unequivocally unconstitutional. You know, it's like that in Canada. There are no mandated vaccines in Canada because it's been deemed to violate the Canadian Constitution. There are just two provinces in Canada, New Brunswick and Ontario, that mandated vaccines. And then one of them, and I think it's New Brunswick, but I could be wrong on it, New Brunswick just recently ditched their mandate. And in the U.S., of course, you have a huge mix, you know, depends upon where you live, either in the fascist Californian state where they mandate it and even want to take your kids away now and have all sorts of snoop rights into your children if you don't vaccinate or if you don't toe the line as the government bureaucrats want you to other states like Florida and Texas where you have exemptions that, you know, philosophical and religious exemptions, as well as the medical exemption that lets you get out of the mandatory vaccines. But these are all under onslaught in the U.S., and a lot of us are doing whatever we can to stop this from going on and to roll back what happened in California, because it's absolutely wrong. It's just flatly immoral, and it shows, speaking of integrity, it shows a lot of integrity lacking by those who push it. And they're almost always in the pocket of the pharmaceutical industry or the vaccine industry. And vaccines aren't about health. You know, if you look at the evidence, you see that the death rate from measles had already dropped 95 to 97% before the measles vaccine was introduced in 1963. Almost all of the diseases in which there are vaccines today, the death rate, mortality rate for those diseases had already dropped significantly in the 90 percentile rate before vaccines were introduced, because it was better nutrition, better sanitation that actually knocked off those diseases. The vaccines were Johnny come latelys, and they're really about money and greed. And ever since the Centers for Disease Control vaccine schedule came on and the 1986 Vaccine Injury Compensation Act was signed into law, passed by Congress, signed into law by Reagan, the vaccine industry is immune from lawsuit. So they get a free ride. And if they get their newly developed vaccine drug, put on the CDC list, then they know they have a $1 billion home run. So do it. No liability, no, you know, feedback mechanism to them that they've done anything wrong. So they don't have to test anything fully, and they don't. And none of these vaccines have been proven safe, certainly not when used in combination. And a lot, increasingly, they're used in combination. And so when I was growing up, I got maybe three or four vaccines, and that was it. But today's kids get up to 70 doses of 16 or 17 vaccines by the time they're 18. 70. You can imagine why that's causing all sorts of vaccine injuries. So this is an example of where they've actually caused more harm than good. The vaccines themselves lack integrity. They're full of toxins, poisons, and even nanoparticles. I talked to two Italian research scientists, Antoinette Gatti, G-A-T-T-I, and Stefano Montanari, and I won't spell that one, and their husband-wife team, and they discovered in all the vaccines in Italy that they, except for one, the one given to pigs, because the hog industry there is very strong, and they forbade it, or they wouldn't use the vaccine. But for humans, all of the vaccines are contaminated with nanoparticles like lead, steel, tungsten carbide, and the like. And what happens is these combine with proteins to make a biocomposite that's very, 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 did I say that enough times? Very, very difficult to get out of your system. And so this is causing huge health problems. Interestingly enough, Gatti and Montanari told me directly, they said, not all of the nanoparticles, though, come from the vaccine. I said, really? Which ones don't? They said, well, tungsten carbide usually comes from the unclean needles. I mean, you mean like dirty needles? No, no, they're new, never been used, but they don't give them an ultrasonic bath, so it doesn't clean away the little metal particles that have been created by the needle being cut and formed, and they are there, and they are then injected into the human. So whether you're a diabetic getting an insulin shot or you're a child getting a vaccination, you're going to get at least some or many nanoparticles. So it's easily taken care of by the needle and syringe makers by just giving them an ultrasonic bath. That'll remove the particles, but, you know, they're too lazy to do it. No one demands that they do it, so it doesn't get done.
And Scott, you mentioned autism. I don't know, a lot are suspicious, the explosion in the rate of children with autism in recent decades is, you know, well, largely, at the very least, due to vaccines, but some, you know, would think almost exclusively. I don't know. I know you would not, you know, you would hate to speculate, but do you think it's, you know, the primary cause of the majority of the autism we're seeing in recent decades?
Well, you kind of had an interesting combination there, the primary cause of a majority. So you kind of hedged your bet there, Richard. But I would say it is one of the primary causes, and this is just my opinion after, you know, spending a lot of time reviewing everything. I'm not a medical doctor, but then maybe that's an advantage, actually. but I think if you combine it, what happens is a lot of these things, see, we just don't know the synergistic effect of a lot of these things that we're doing. How do the toxins, the aluminum, which is far worse than the mercury, by the way, the aluminum, the mercury, the formaldehyde, the polysorbate 80 that are in many vaccines and are injected directly into the body, how do those all interact? How do they interact with glyphosate? How do they interact with any of the contaminants that are there? No one, I guarantee you, no one's done the testing on that. And they couldn't. It'd be incredibly difficult to construct and very difficult, very expensive to do. So that probably explains why it hasn't been done. And there's so many different factors. And how do they interact in the presence of an electromagnetic field? How does it interact in the presence of a strong and healthy immune system as opposed to a weaker immune system? You know, boys are more adversely affected by these over-vaccinations than girls are. Why is that? Well, boys take longer for their immune systems to mature. They take longer to mature. So when they're attacked with these vaccines, their immune system isn't quite as developed as the girls, and hence you have the higher rate. And so the immune system's formation and how strong it is, how strong was the mother when she, how healthy was she? Was she on a diet of Coke and potato chips, or was she eating a very healthy, strong diet, taking certain supplements and the like? And the baby that was produced in a trauma-free environment was hence much stronger. Was it a C-section as opposed to a vaginal birth? You know, did the baby get the antibodies as it slid through the birth canal, or did it get C-sectioned and have none of those? Is it being breastfed? You know, is it getting those? You know, there are all so many factors that figure in. It's very tough to control for all those factors. But to answer your question, yes, I think a large part of it is from the over-vaccination of infants far too early in life, and especially with so many unnecessary ones. You know, they don't need the hepatitis B vaccine unless it's absolutely called for because you have a hepatitis B positive mother. And yet they still give it to kids. Why the Gardasil? You know, it hasn't even been proven to prevent cervical cancer in girls. Now they're giving the stupid vaccine to boys as well. That's insanity. It doesn't, you know, just take a lot of vitamin D, strengthen your immune system, take vitamin K2, D3, K2, and occasionally some vitamin A, and you'll have a really strong immune system. Mercury, if you ingest mercury, you know, selenium is a magnet for mercury. It, you know, clanks onto it like there's no tomorrow and takes it out of your system. So that's why the mercury levels in fish, for example, are not as important to know as the selenium and mercury levels in fish, because if there's a lot of selenium in fish, or if you take it supplementally, when you eat the fish, the mercury isn't really much of a problem because it will be glommed onto by the selenium and taken out of your system. The toxicity levels of the mercury will be far, far less. A lot of people don't know that, but they prefer the drug approach or the avoidance approach or whatever it might be. But if your listeners take away any message from any of this, of what we've said today, it's really to be careful of the mainstream authorities and what they say. You can really die a horrible, horrible death from it because of the misinformation, the even disinformation that's out there. And one thing I've noticed from all they've done at Codex and domestically and the like is that if you boil it down to one factor, all of those things, too many contaminants in the food, aluminum, the over-vaccinations, the EMFs, the glyphosate, you find the common intersecting circle there is fertility. It's reducing fertility of the population. And whether they're doing it deliberately or just inadvertently, it doesn't really matter because the effect is that fertility levels in humans is being reduced drastically. And that's what's going on, and I think that's a real danger to the human race. I see what's going on is very anti-human, whether it's this over-vaccine push, whether it's the, you know, without any vaccine safety review, whether it's allowing Monsanto to use Roundup everywhere and just kill us off with glyphosate because it's definitely reducing the sperm count in young men, and it's causing cancer, and it's causing all sorts of problems. I mean, Roundup should be so illegal it wouldn't even be funny. And so that's what we're fighting for at some of the Codex committees, by the way. We're the only ones at the Codex committee in Beijing last spring who spoke out against glyphosate. No one else did, not even the other consumer groups. It was just NHF. And believe it or not, we are only supported by our members and donors who give us money. And I guarantee you, it's not government. It's not big corporations. It's just mom and pop operations and you and me. And that's kind of it. And that's what keeps us going against all these multi-million dollar funded outfits. So we really appreciate any donations from your listeners, because that's what we really are, your voice for health and for health freedom at the topmost level, the global level, the Codex level. So, and even those people who were so foresighted enough as to mention us in their will, that's really what's kept us going as well. We have one guy, Joseph Weston, who left his estate to us. We get paid, you know, every quarter a certain check. And he's really saved us several times. You know, he died 25 years ago. And yet his legacy is still long outliving him because of it. So, you know, the funny thing is, any of your listeners can have a direct impact on the world stage by helping us out, because it goes from the listener to us and from us to Codex. And that's how the message travels. If I have time to tell you one inspirational story, I did tell you about the victory in 2009 where we stopped cold. I was the delegate there for NHF. We stopped cold their attempt to dumb down the vitamin and mineral levels in supplements and foods. We stopped that cold. But you know why we were there was because a gentleman in Dublin, Ireland gave us $1,000 that allowed us to pay our expenses to go to that meeting and speak out. You know, if he hadn't given that $1,000, I wouldn't have been there. So who's the health hero? Is it me for speaking out, or is it him for having given us the $1,000? I would say it was him, because we wouldn't even be there. So you can see there's a chance for people to make a direct impact on what goes on the world stage. And I really encourage your listeners to join us and to help make a difference.
Well, thank you very much, Scott. And yes, please, everyone out there, you know, do what you can, donate what you can to the National Health Federation here. And you can see just how altruistic and full of integrity, as Scott Tipps mentioned so many times, his work with all of this is. We only have about a minute or two left. Scott, thank you so much for being here. I noticed also they're attacking merchant accounts. And
Yes. That's for another time when you have me on. I'll be happy to address that. But they do all sorts of – you're very well-informed, Richard, I can tell. And they do all sorts of different ways of attacking us. But it is all anti-human. Just remember that word. It was actually a phrase mentioned by Catherine Austin Fitz. Anti-human. She deserves credit for it. But that is what they're doing. It's all, and why, who knows, but it's all anti-human.
Well, thank you so much, Scott. And I look forward to having you on again when you're in the States. Have a great evening.
Thank you. Thank you, Richard. Enjoyed it very much. Thanks.
Thank you. Have a great night.
Bye. You too. Bye.
All right, everyone. Well, that was Scott Tipps. Yeah, you can check out more information. Go to thenhf.com. Please contribute what you can. And we will speak again soon. Thank you all for listening. And transcend the construct. Regards.